God be with you. I'm very happy to be here this morning. Let me just start by telling you a little bit about myself. I was born in Michigan, so when I was almost 6 years old, we moved to a mid-sized town in southeast Texas, and that's pretty much where I grew up. I went to university at Texas A&M University. I got my Bachelor's of Science there. Then I went to the rival school, University of Texas at Austin, and I got my PhD in sociology there. I taught there for a year after I graduated, and then I taught at Oklahoma State University. In about the year 2000, we moved to this area, and so I've been here about 17 years now, and I live in Montgomery County in Maryland. I converted to Islam about 18 years ago. I'm married to an immigrant. My husband's from Turkey. He's a U.S. citizen now. And this September, we're going to be celebrating, God willing, our 25th anniversary. We have two kids. They're
both in middle school. Oops. See, I went off. They're both in middle school. And let me just try pushing this button again.
Okay. Let me sit up here. Yes, so I have my kids a little bit late. They're both in middle school right now. And I have a boy and a girl. So I'm really happy to be here. Right now I have my own business.
I didn't touch it. I have my own business.
It's a language translation company. And it's just a small business. I do it part-time. I have some corporate and nonprofit clients, but I also serve
a very large. I also serve the very large immigrant population that we have here. I do a lot of personal documents, so every day I'm seeing, you know, all of humanity come across my doorstep with their papers as they're in the process to acquire legal citizenship, or at least legal residency, in the United States. Because as you might know, it's a very long process. It takes about 6 years to become a citizen in this country. I also do a lot of volunteer work. So I serve on the board at the Ezra Bloom Mosque with Bilal, Imam Bilal, who was here last week. And what I want to do today is, I know some of you missed last week. I know at least one of you. I met at the parking lot, said she was not here last week. So I'm just going to, my topic today is to talk about a woman in Islam, but I'm just going to start with a very brief introduction about Islam, in case you missed, or just to refresh you. So can you guys hear me okay? All right, good. So I'm going to give you the 101 of the 101 of Islam, or the intro to the intro. So just very briefly, you know, first of all, it's an Abrahamic faith. So Islam accepts all of the Abrahamic prophets. Muslims believe that there were 124,000 prophets throughout all of human history. Of course, we don't know the exact number. But it says in the Quran that there is not a place on the earth, not a people that were left without guidance. But there were only 315 messengers. And messengers, what distinguishes a prophet from a messenger? A messenger is one that actually convey the message from God. So the actual words. They were given the scripture, you could say. Of these, 25 of them are specifically mentioned in the Quran. So we accept all the Abrahamic prophets, from Adam to Abraham, Moses, Noah, etc., Jesus. And we believe that Muhammad was the last prophet and came with the final message, and that he came to really perfect the Abrahamic religion. So in Islam, you see a balance between having a spiritual law, like you have in Judaism, but also a big emphasis on mercy and love, you know, that we get through the, as you know, Muslims consider Jesus to be a prophet. So as we get through the prophethood of Jesus, which is really this message of love and the importance of love. And Muslims consider Prophet Muhammad to be the most merciful of all creation, that he embodied mercy. And so in Islam, you find this balance. We follow a sacred law, but it's also really important that we are good neighbors, kind, merciful people. And also through Islam, you have some of the more of the difficult laws that the Jewish people follow were lifted. The religion in that way was kind of simplified, and there are several hadiths about it, that your religion is made simple for you. It's not supposed to be difficult or a burden for you. And also, it's a religion, it's a monotheistic religion relevant to all places and time. So it's not a culture, although a lot of Muslims today confuse their culture with their religion, unfortunately. So rather, it's something that can come up in a society. You can preserve your culture and also be Muslim. So the most important, I know Bill Hodge, he went over the basics of faith and the pillars and everything. So the most important tenet of faith is a testimony of faith. And this is just very simply when one affirms that they believe in one God and that Prophet Muhammad is the messenger of God. And this is actually the saying that if you believe this, then you're considered Muslim. So actually becoming Muslim is very simple. You don't have to take a year of catechism classes or, oh, that's what I also wanted to mention to you. I was raised Roman Catholic, and I'm one of seven kids. We're a Scotch-Irish Roman Catholic family, and my oldest sister became a nun. So my parents raised us very religiously and to believe in God, and we all prayed together every morning. Okay, so with all that I've said, it follows that we accept the Jewish and Christian people as our close relatives. And in fact, they're called the people of the book, is how they're referred to in the Quran. And Muslims are ordered to respect to respect Jewish and Christian people. It's part of our faith. So like this nonsense that happened in Egypt over the Holy Easter weekend, this is absolutely 100% against the teachings of Islam. So we believe the Quran is the word of God delivered by the Archangel Gabriel. In fact, you will see some of the same angels mention my name. We also have them in our faith, of course. It's the same angels. So the Archangel Gabriel, he's the messenger angel. So this is the medium through which Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, received the message, which is the Quran. And the Quran is considered the greatest miracle. And actually, Prophet Muhammad, he's only mentioned four times in the Quran. And this is because the focus is not to be on him.
Keep talking.
You want me to try?
You keep talking.
Yeah.
Of course, the Prophet Muhammad's life, his teachings are very central to the Islamic faith. But the idea is that they didn't want to turn into the people who are actually worshiping Prophet Muhammad. So Moses, on the other hand, he's mentioned over 100 times in the Quran. His story is told in from many different perspectives. And the Quran stands for all time as the greatest miracle. So Muslims consider it the literal word of God, and It's preserved in its original Arabic. And the great miracle of the Quran, and there is no other book in the existence of humanity, is that it hasn't changed from the time of the revelation to today.
So the Quran is in... I'm just going to like talk to you, then I make sure everybody hears. Okay. Sorry, it's a little distracting for me. Yeah, so it's unchanged. Yeah, we have translations of the Quran, but the original Quran, letter by letter, is unchanged. And the Arabic in the Quran, of course, it's a special formalized Arabic that's used, and it's still studied and learned today. It's considered the formal Arabic. But of course, languages evolve over time, right? And, but the Quran, Arabic, stays the same. It's still learned and taught, and anybody can learn it. It is, at the beginning, a complex language, but it's also extremely elegant, and it's a compacted language. You can have one word, and it's going to have the verb in it, the gender of the subject in it, and can convey like seven different meanings. So it's really fascinating language. But Arabic people, of course, dialects evolve over time, and even Arabic people have to study the formal language of the Quran in order to learn it. And it's really amazing, the people that didn't grow up learning Arabic or learning the sounds, because they do have different sounds in their alphabet, can learn it, even as an adulthood, can learn how to do it. And even myself, I learned how to recite the Quran and read Arabic, and it's really
an amazing thing to be able to read these words. You get a lot of spiritual feeling from reading the words that were came from the Creator. Okay, I feel like a different person every time it goes on and off. Okay, Muslims. And did any of you guys see the exhibit that was at the Freer Gallery? It was there for several months. It was historical Qurans. It was really fascinating. Anyway, it's gone now. But Muslims believe in Mary, the mother of Jesus. We accept the virgin birth. And we believe that Jesus will come again as the Messiah. These are all parts of Islamic belief. Muslims make a once-in-a-lifetime pilgrimage to Hajj, to Mecca. And this is where the original house of God, the Kaaba, is. And this was believed by the Muslims to be built by Abraham and his son Ishmael. And you guys know the story of Abraham, I'm sure, that he went with his maidservant, Hagar, in Arabic it's Hagar, and left her in this desolate, deserted place, no civilization, no water, barren rock. You go there, it's barren rock. It's all covered with marble now, but you can still see around in the area that it's barren rock. And he left her there. And as Abraham was leaving, Hagar asked him, "Did your Lord tell you to leave me here?" And Abraham answered, "Yes." And so Hagar said she accepted that, and that she would be taken care of. And so she didn't protest. And she was a very faithful servant. And maybe you know the story. Hagar, she's there with her baby. You know, eventually her water ran out, her days ran out. And you can imagine, if you're a mother, how frantic you might be. There's nobody around. There's no sign of life. And so there are these two hills, not so far apart. And what she did is she ran back and forth between these two hills. They're called Safa and Marwa. I have a friend, she's Marwa, she named her daughter Safa. But she ran back and forth between these two hills seven times, all the way up looking around. She's looking for like birds, which might show like where water is, any kind of sign of life, like frantically running, looking for water. She did this 7 times, and then there are different narrations. Some say the archangel Gabriel came down and tapped his wing on the ground. Others say her son. But what happened is that the spring of Zamzam came up at that spot, and that she had water. And she started collecting that water. And that spring is still running today, and it's feeding all of the pilgrims with water. It has not run dry, and that water has all kinds of special properties. It's very healing water. Some people, when they go on Hajj, they drink that all day. They don't get hungry. It sustains them. And but who was Hajar? She was basically the handmaiden, or we might say even the slave, of Abraham. You know, Abraham's wife was Sarah, but Sarah was barren, and so Abraham wanted to have his lineage preserved, and this was done through Hajar. Of course, we all know Sarah later did have a son. But at the time, she was black, a slave, a woman. Basically, she had the lowest status in her society. And it's really amazing story that God elevated her to the highest status of all womankind. What I just described to you, the running back and forth, this is part of the Hajj rites. Every pilgrim, in order to complete their Hajj, has to do as she did and run back and forth between these two hills 7 times and reflect on her story and say the same prayers that she said. She's buried next to the Kaaba. Prophet Abraham is not buried next to the Kaaba. She is. So she is buried in what Muslims consider to be the most holiest site on earth. And she is, her story is the one that gets acted out at the Hajj. And so I think this says a lot about what is the status of women in Islam, is that God took who was at the lowest status in society and elevated to the highest, such that even 1,400 years later, we're still reenacting her story. So just a couple words about practices. Muslims do 5 daily prayers. These take about 2 to 4 minutes at a minimum. Of course, you can make them longer. This might seem like incredible. To me, when I became Muslim, I was like, how am I gonna do that? It seemed a little bit overwhelming. But maybe you know that early Christians observed 7 prayer times, and maybe your ministers or your clergy people still have certain prayer times that they observe. I know in the Catholic Church, the priests and nuns do have certain prayer times they still observe. Jewish people have 3 prayer times they observe. So it actually is part of our Abrahamic faith. And it's one of those things that once you start doing, you find that you can't live without doing. Kind of like when you start exercising, after a while your body is telling you it wants to exercise. Hopefully you get to that point eventually. So another aspect of our practice is we give away 2.5% of our wealth every year. And we're encouraged to give charity regularly. A key point about these practices is their universality. Anywhere on earth since the establishment of prayer 1,400 years ago, a Muslim can go and pray. I can go to any mosque anywhere in the world, and I'm not going to be lost. I can follow the prayers. There might be some small variations about where you put your hands during certain parts of the prayer, but overall, it's the same. And even Shia and Sunni, they pray the same way. You have millions of people at Hajj. We have 5 daily prayers. You think that might be like a nightmare to organize, but it's not. The adhan goes off, which is the call to prayer, and everybody just gets in rows. Everybody knows which ways to face. It just takes like a minute. people or more all lined up ready to pray. It's really an amazing thing. We also, Ramadan is starting at sunset on Friday, God willing. And this is 30 days of fasting, which Muslims fast from dawn, which is about an hour and a half before sunrise, until sunset. And it's a fast from food, water, sexual intercourse. You're also supposed to fast with your tongue, your eyes, you know, no gossip. You're not supposed to gossip anytime, but you're supposed to be extra careful about what you say, what you watch. So really kind of a purification time. But what is the purpose of this religion? You know, what's behind all of these rituals? And these rituals, they take us out of our heedlessness. And this is what we humans are in a state of most of the time, is a state of heedlessness. They bring us back to remembrance of our Creator. They reorient our compass away from our worldly desires and towards God. They put our ego and our base human desires in their proper place. They remind us of our life's purpose, which is to serve God. And what does that mean? You know, on one level, it means that we live our life in a way that would please Him. For a Muslim, your whole life can be worship. And this was something that really kind of astounded me when I first became Muslim, is that I was told that any act you do can be worship. It depends on your intention. If you are doing this for the sake of God, to please God, that it becomes an act of worship. Anything. Breathing. If you do that with remembrance, that it is God that gives you permission to breathe. We believe that one day, the day of judgment, we will meet our Creator and we'll have to answer for how we live our lives, how we use our time. And all of this really boils down to perfecting our character. Being kinder, living with more sincerity, being merciful towards others, living according to the famous saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, none of you will enter paradise until he wants for his neighbor what he wants for himself. So this is very similar to the golden rule. So this is the 101 of Islam. If you have other questions, I can answer them later. And now I want to get to the topic of women in Islam. So first, we have to go back to 7th century Arabia, because I think a lot of times, a lot of misunderstandings come in is that we try to understand a practice or teaching with our 21st century mindset. So what was the state of 7th century Arabia? It was a tribal society. You know, what does that mean? Today we live in very controlled nation states. We have very formalized rules of law, but it wasn't like that then. It was a tribal society. That meant your tribe was your protection. There wasn't like police officers and courts and all of this. So people gave you your rights and respect out of fear of your tribe. And knowing that if they didn't do right by you, your tribe would back you and make things right. At this time, women had few rights. They were considered the property of men. A man could marry an unlimited number of women. At the time of Prophet Muhammad, there was a very wealthy man. He had over 100 wives. When the husband died, the wives could be inherited by the brother. You know, that's another evidence that they were property. Having a baby girl was seen as a burden. Unfortunately, we still see that in some societies today. Female infanticide was common, and the practice was that girls would be taken out to the desert and buried alive. I mean, you can see, like, such a brutal society. It was also a pagan society. At that time, in the Kaaba, of course, the Kaaba was there, right? Because, you know, Prophet Abraham was 6,000 years ago. It was full of 365 idols. So this is the society that Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, was born into. And his prophethood started at age 40. You should probably know Moses' prophethood started at age 40. I mean, this is a very typical age when prophethood starts. And then you think about that in terms of your own life, too. And so his prophet photo was just 23 years. Just 23 years. And because he died when he was 63. And during his lifetime, all of that changed. I mean, this is really remarkable. He went from a pagan society to a monotheistic society. All of those idols were gone during his lifetime. And you could even say that he was the first feminist. You know, it's hard to understand that today in the context of everything we hear about Islam. But his first wife was Khadija. She was a wealthy businesswoman. She was a widow. She was a two-time widow. She was also 15 years older than him. And she also proposed marriage to him. So these kind of facts were not common at his time, and they're not common in our time either. But she was a businesswoman, she did trade, and she needed someone to run her caravans, to take her goods to as far as away to Syria to sell them. And you can imagine, you need somebody very trustworthy to do a job like that. Because you just have to take their word for it. You don't know how much they sold your goods for. You don't know if they're pocketing some of your money, whatever. And Muhammad, at that time, he was, you know, in his 20s, early 20s, and he was known as the trustworthy. That was kind of his nickname, that he was known by. He was known for his honesty. Everybody agreed that he was absolutely 100% honest. And so she wanted to hire him, and she got to know him and proposed marriage to him. In fact, all of Prophet Muhammad's wives, with the exception of one, all of them were divorced or widowed women. And think of it, at that time, this was something very important, to take care of a woman. As a part of Islam, this was something that he and his companions were very careful about, is to take care of a woman who were part of their new tribe of Islam. And think about today. How much care do we give to our widows today? Are we looking after them? If they want to get married, are we helping them find a spouse? If we're a man, are we willing to marry a widow, a divorced woman? But this was like really important, that the woman have dignity and honor and be in a marriage if that's what they wanted. So over this 23-time period of revelation, there were certain rights given to women, established in the Quran. Women were given property rights. So they went from being property to being given property rights. There are inheritance rights specified in the Quran. So a woman must receive an inheritance from her relatives. It's part of the law. Women could be reliable witnesses for business transactions and other legal matters. You know, this was something really revolutionary at that time. You weren't even thinking about women so much being in business or working in the business sphere, and here they were accepted as legal witnesses for business transactions. They have the right to divorce. And even, some of you, I see a lot of gray hairs here. And I remember late 70s, early 80s, I went with my mom to the bank. She wanted to either open an account or get a credit card. And I guess she had gone back to work, and the bank refused her. They said, no, you need to come back. You have to have your husband's signature. You cannot open an account on your own. And I know also the divorce laws. You used to have to declare adultery if you wanted to get divorced. In some states, and I'm sure you guys know better than me, the restrictions that we have on divorce just 20 years ago in this country. And I just learned recently in Maryland, you have to be separated for a whole year before you can get divorced. So women have the right to receive maintenance after divorce. So the idea is you couldn't cast a woman aside. You married her, you had certain responsibilities with that, even if you divorced her. They had the right to all of their property acquired before and after marriage, during marriage. So any woman's earnings are hers. considered hers. If she wants to contribute that to the household, she's welcome to, but she doesn't have to. They're hers. They have the right to refuse a marriage proposal. The number of wives a man can have is limited to 4. They have the right to be educated. In fact, there are many hadiths about the importance of education, and education is something really strongly encouraged in Islam. And also, they cannot be barred or discouraged from coming into the mosque. And here are a couple of sayings of Prophet Muhammad about the status of women. The best of you are those who are best to their wives. Paradise lies at the feet of mothers. Even the one of God's names is Ar-Rahman, Ar-Rahim. And these two names mean the all-merciful, the most merciful, the merciful. They come from the root letters R-H-M, Rahman, Rahim. You guys can hear those root letters in there. These are the same root letters that are used for the word for the womb. So the womb is also reflected or manifestation of God's name of being the most merciful. And you can consider the womb is a place of mercy. The womb is also a place where Muslims believe after about 3 months, the soul from paradise, from heaven, from the world of souls, enters into the fetus at this point. And this is happening in a woman's body, straight from heaven to the woman's womb. And this is happening in women. So women are, you know, it's part of this sacred feminine notion that is part of Islam. And it's really, like, I love to hold a newborn baby. They have that smell, right? They have that wonderful smell. To me, this is like the smell of heaven is on that baby. That first couple of weeks especially, you can still have that trail. So, now it's really interesting. When I was in graduate school, I took this course on gender theory. Yeah, I was like hardcore feminist. And one of the theory books we read used all female pronouns. Because the author was trying to make a point about, does this like sound natural to you? Is it jarring to you? You know, why do we always use a male pronoun? And this, of course, we know is the structure of our language, right? We use a male pronoun by default, even when we mean male, female. So this is also a construct of the Arabic language too. A lot of times the male pronoun is used, but it's applying to men and women. But even today, at that time, there was a woman. She came to Prophet Muhammad and she asked him, she said, "Oh, how come the Quran doesn't address us women the same way it addresses men?" You know, isn't that amazing? Like 1,400 years ago, the same thing that you can hear young people saying today. And even my daughter might say, "Come on, you guys." She's like, "Guys, guys." So, and there was a verse that answered this woman back. And this is the verse. It says, "Indeed, the Muslim men and Muslim women, the believing men and believing women, the obedient men and obedient women, the truthful men and truthful women, the patient men and patient women, the humble men and humble women, the charitable men and charitable women, the fasting men and fasting women, the men who guard their private parts and the women who do so, and the men who remember Allah often and the women who do so, for them Allah has prepared forgiveness and a great reward." So, and there are a few other verses that are kind of similar to this, where it specifies men and women. Of course, you can see, if you do the whole text like this, it gets to be kind of very awkward. But there is this end where the Quran refers, using the male pronoun, it's meaning, you know, all humans. But this verse here specifically, or came shortly after the question was asked, as a response that, and this is also really important here because it's one of several places in the Quran where spiritual equality between men and women is specified. And it also kind of lays out what is a believer too, right? One who's obedient, truthful, patient, humble, fasting, modest, remembering their creator. For them is forgiveness and a great reward. So we have this notion of spiritual equality in Islam. And it's specified, it's not your sex, it's not your race, it's not your tribe. None of these are what defines you, your value as a human being. So rather it's your piety. This is the measure by which God measures. You know, what is the soundness of your heart? This is the criteria. And I'll just want to highlight, there's a couple differences. We have basically the same creation story as is in the Bible, but there are a couple differences. And one is there's no idea that Eve was created from the rib of Adam. One of the verses, this is in, there's a whole chapter in the Quran called Anisa, which means the women. It says, O mankind, be conscious of your duty to your Lord who created you from a single soul, and from it created its mate of the same kind. And from them twain is spread a multitude of men and women. And it's interesting here, a single soul is neither male nor female. Although we could understand that single soul to be Adam, it's not necessarily so. In fact, the word soul is a feminine word, and the word mate is masculine. But I'm not suggesting that woman came first. Other parts of the Quran, the creation of Adam is described. But the gender relationship in this verse is ambivalent. And the mate was created from the soul. So it was created from the same essence. Because some Christians have argued that historically that women don't have souls because they were created from a rib. I mean, I know most Christians today don't believe that, but this has been an argument in the past. So the creation story makes it clear that women are made of the same soul as men. Their capacity for good and evil is equal with that of men. In other verses, this concept is emphasized. We find that it's good deeds and awareness of God which makes the believer, male or female, noble in the sight of God. Indeed, the noblest of you in the sight of Allah is the most pious, and whoever does right, whether male or female, all will enter the garden. Another verse, never will I suffer to be lost the work of any one of you, male or female. Whoever works righteousness, man or woman, and has faith, verily to him we give a new life that is good and pure. We will bestow on such the reward according to their actions. Also about the falling out of paradise, there's no idea in the Quran that Eve is blamed for tempting Adam to eat the apple. And the Quran says, then Satan whispered to him. He said, O Adam, shall I direct you to the tree of eternity and possession that will not deteriorate? And Adam and his wife ate of it, and their private parts became apparent to them, and they began to fasten over themselves from the leaves of paradise. And Adam disobeyed his Lord and erred. Then his Lord chose him and returned to him in forgiveness and guided him. So we don't have this idea that Eve is a temptress. We also don't have an idea of original sin. Adam and Eve were forgiven right away. You know, Adam and Eve turned and asked for forgiveness, and they were forgiven. You know, they were still thrown down here to the earth and all of that, but they were still thrown out of paradise, but they were forgiven. So we have these important theological concepts in Islam: spiritual equality, equality in creation, equal opportunity to achieve spiritual righteousness. There's no blaming of the female sex. And we have all of the rights that were given to women under Islam. Okay, so you guys are probably all hearing this. You say, oh, well, that sounds great. And when I was studying Islam, deciding to get my mother converted or not, I was like, wow, all this sounds really great. So it was very appealing to me and kind of left, made it for a some of the things that had it had, you know, troubled me about Catholic theology. I was like, oh, wow, this sounds really great. But I'm a sociologist, right? And I knew, like, where is women's inequality the greatest? It's in Muslim countries. So, you know, a sociologist, and one of my areas I studied was the labor force, economy, all of that. We have all of these different social indicators we use to measure what is the status of women in a country. And I knew, where is the status the lowest? It's in Muslim countries. So I was like, okay, why? Why is that? And, you know, on one level, it's not really a fair question, because it makes a mistake that I think a lot of us make today when we're trying to understand Islam, is that it equates whatever the reality is today with the religion. So the religion is one thing, what people do is another thing. And we know that saying you're a Catholic, Methodist, Jewish, Muslim, Hindu is not equivalent to being a representative of that faith. Another point is that nation states, they have their own complex reality that's separate from the religion of the people. And just because some countries, people identify as mostly Christian or mostly Muslim, it doesn't mean that that country is all, I mean, look at the U.S., right? We're not all uniformly practicing the same religion or whatever. Also, many Muslim countries have been colonized. And colonization does a great deal of harm. Maybe some of you have worked in different countries, experienced this firsthand, but it also has a lot of psychological components on the person. Because, you know, what happens when you're colonized? It's the foreign entities coming over and running your country. It's basically taking agency away from you. And you have a lot of word helplessness that takes generations to overcome. Because when you're kind of confined in what you can do, it short-tails your imagination or your thinking or hopes about what can be. And what happens if you study gender relations under colonization is that patriarchy gets more firm, it gets more entrenched. And you could think like the family as a kind of microcosm of society. So on the one hand, you have the colonizers are kind of controlling the country. The men and the people of that country have limits to their own self-determination. And then you see the same kind of relationships reproduced in the home, where the men then are confining the woman their own kind of self-determination. So it's really kind of great psychological harm. I mean, this is a very long, complex topic to understand all of this and tease it out. And then just frankly, a lot of Muslims, they don't know their religion. They don't know even just what I shared with you today. So they have the Quran, but it's in this classical Arabic. Maybe they haven't, it's on the shelf in their home, but maybe they haven't read it, they don't understand it. And so this is a big problem as well. And then what is a culture, has been the culture or practice in that country? Oftentimes it's treated as if it was an Islamic rule or law, when in fact it might be in complete contradiction to what Islam teaches. So the reality is there's a big gap between theology and practice. Human beings have this perennial problem of failing to live up to our ideals. And we also see another problem in the Islamic world. I'm sorry, I really didn't mean to talk this long. I need to have some question and answer. Where people, governments, social movements, they're using Islam as politics. So you have this whole political Islam. And whenever you use a religion in service of politics, you know, it doesn't end well, regardless of what the religion is. Are we done at 10? Well, then my supreme apologies.
You're fine.
Good question.
Yes.
Why do you wear the headscarf?
So I wear the headscarf. start as part of my religious observation. For me, it's a devotional act. So, most Muslim scholars, although there's some debate on the issue, believe that this is part of the religious practices. It's not like, you know, it's not on the same level as fasting, praying, giving charity, going to Hajj, etc. But it is one of the devotional practices. And so this is something that I do. And when I'm in public, is to, basically the rule is to be modestly dressed, which applies for both men and women. And in fact, the verse in the Quran about being modest mentions men first. And the basic rule is that you cover your all that which is readily apparent, meaning your face, your hands, and some schools say also your feet. So that's why I do it. It doesn't mean anything political. It has nothing to do with belonging to this group or that group. It's not any kind of, it's just a devotional act like a nun or an Amish person would cover. And in fact, if you just go back a century in our country, you will see a lot of our century, you know, around early 1900s, most American women were covering their hair in some manner and they went out. And still in the world today, most places in the world, women cover, you know, regardless of their religion, this practice of modesty. Yes. Yes.
There was a picture in the paper yesterday, I believe it was, of the women going to vote in Iran, and they were all in black, and there was a little girl in all this colorful clothing, and I thought it was such a contrast. I thought, do little girls get to wear colorful clothing and it's only when you get to be an adult woman that you have to cover up in black?
Well, there's no like Quranic stricture that you have to wear black. This is something the mullahs in Iran have decided, as have those in Saudi Arabia, that women have to wear black. But, you know, there's more than, I don't know, what, 60 Muslim countries? If you line up pictures, some of those women are dressed very colorfully. And we have a lot of African immigrants at my mosque in Germantown, and you will see on Eid Day all kinds of vibrant, bright colors. But the covering, yeah, the law, the part of the spiritual law is once you reach puberty, this is when then this becomes incumbent on you. So yeah.
It's good to be a little girl.
Yes.
I respect your devotion to the original scripture and that it's the same and unchanging. But I'm wondering if maybe like the Gutenberg Bible and the printing press took it out of Latin and put it in vernacular languages and so that more people could really understand what their religion was about. Is there any thinking at all in Islam that maybe that would be helpful? Because like you were saying.
Yeah, this is very important. And yes, this is going on. There, Quran is translated into many, many languages. But it's also important, the translation, because we're human beings and we often translate things within the context of our culture.
Right.
So if you're in a highly patriarchal culture, you might translate some of these verses in a way that you interpreted in that context, which maybe is not meant by the Quran. So we always have to keep that Quran for scholars to understand, because one verb can have several meanings, just like in English. And it has to be informed by knowing the whole Quran and knowing how the Prophet lived his life and interpreted the Quran in his time and all of that. So, yeah, like for example, there's a project with the Indonesian government because the Quran is translated into Indonesian languages, but there's concern that the existing translations were actually giving people radical ideas. So there's actually a committee at the government level to, I don't know, maybe it's done now, to retranslate the Quran in a way that's kind of more keeping with how we understand the words today and being careful not to translate things in a way that leads to radical ideas. So Yeah, definitely. It is translated in many languages, but also I have to pay attention to how it's translated. So, and we have many English translations of the Quran too. And there are websites actually you can go and you can look at one verse and you can see the 9 different translations of that, you know, one verse.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
for being here.
Sure.
This is really wonderful. And I'm ready to